moral of the story is you get one life, so do it all.
And I think building a company is really hard. You have to have a lot of passion for what you're doing. It requires your greatest persuasive abilities to hire the best people you can. You've got to be a really good talent scout. Because no matter how smart you are, you need a team of great people.
Welcome to our latest episode of Hire Smarter. Our mission is to help building materials leaders adopt the best practices for hiring talent while helping professionals make better career decisions. How effective are you at predicting who will be a great leader? The irony of this question is we can all list fairly quickly poor leaders that we've worked for in the past. It was no secret. Everyone knew who those poor leaders were in every organization, but yet consistently, making great leadership hiring decisions remains a challenge. Our guest today is Dr. Hogan, the founder of Hogan Assessments. Hogan Assessments remains the leading professional assessment tool in the world. Dr. Hogan, PhD from Cal Berkeley, professor of psychology at Johns Hopkins, past Department of Psychology chair at Tulsa University, and author of several books. Dr. Hogan's research and years of experience helping companies make great leadership hiring decisions and backtesting that process along the way has earned Hogan Assessments top honors. Common trait in the most brilliant people that I've met is their ability to take the seemingly complex challenges in front of us and actually develop very simple solutions and explanations. And Dr. Hogan does a terrific job here identifying what the three factors are that predict who will be a great leader. What are the top traits of poor leaders? And this answer is going to surprise a lot of people. If we know the top traits that predict great leaders, why are companies so continually poor at selecting leadership? Dr. Hogan gives us some great words of wisdom here in stating that, hey, the question to be asked is, how do we get rid of the bad leaders? Enjoy our conversation as Dr. Hogan and I talk about the Hogan Personality Inventory, the HPI, which is just simply what the bright side of our personality is that we kind of show to the outside world. We also talk about the Hogan Development Survey, the HDS, which gets into the dark side, which is fascinating and basically kind of identifies how we unravel as personalities as the pressure increases. We also talk about the Motives, Values, and Preferences Inventory, the MVPI, which describes really what our core values are and what our drivers are as an individual. Buckle up, grab your coffee, and enjoy the conversation. I must admit, RT, this was rather very humbling and intimidating preparing for this when I understand the breadth of work that you've created and kind of what the science and everything that kind of came behind creating Hogan Assessments. I mean, and the fact that it remains a leading, psychological assessment tool today. I mean, there's gotta be some great stories behind that. And beyond that, Jim Cavanaugh specifically told me that building up Hope Lumber, that this was the most critical tool in their process.
Yeah, well, we get that 100% of the time from people who actually use it and pay attention. I mean, like almost every day we get a note saying, you changed my life.
Wow.
It's pretty cool. But we're just a small fish in a really large ocean. All our competitors are billion-dollar companies.
Right, right.
And we're a $50 million company. So we're just swimming in a tank full of sharks.
Yeah, and that's, I understand. RT, help me. What was the vision? What was the basis that kind of created Hogan Assessments? And was that at, when you're getting your PhD at Cal Berkeley, or was that when you're a professor at Johns Hopkins? Where did this develop?
Well, there are, I think, three parts to it. I'm a retired naval officer. my experience in the Navy sensitized me to the problem of leadership. Military leadership is an oxymoron. As I used to say, when I got out, I would start my own Navy and I could beat that one. So A, leadership really important. B, I worked for 2 years as a probation officer in East Los Angeles. We made decisions about 4, 5, 6, 7 kids every week, life-changing decisions. And it was the same decisions every week. Should we put them in the military? Should we send them to prison? Should we put them in a foster home? Should we put them in juvenile detention? Should we put them on probation? Making decisions about people, recurring decisions about people over and over again. And they were, and I had put a lot of work into those recommendations, and my bosses would blow me off. They'd say, well, this reminds me of time back in 42. This reminds me of time back in 58. This reminds me of a case I used to have. And I thought, there's got to be a way to do this in a systematic way, because it makes a difference. You're going to change your kids' lives. So you're going to make decisions about people's lives. You ought to do it in a rational and defensible way. And so there's leadership, and there's how you make decisions about people. And then in graduate school, I worked at this institute that was set up to study creativity and the methods they use. And so it's a question of, you know, here you're going to hire architects. How do you hire a creative one? You're going to hire leaders. How do you hire a good one? You're going to put some kind of correctional treatment in place for a kid. How do you do it correctly? So it's formally from a statistical perspective, it's the same problem. How do you identify creativity? How do you identify leadership? So the methods I learned in graduate school, I could apply to these recurring problems. The question is, how do you make decisions about people regarding their careers, their occupation, who to hire, who to fire, who to promote, who to demote, who to put in charge, who to remove from charge, and how do you do that in a way that maximizes your outcomes, you know, that you can defend in court these days, because you have to be able to defend it if you didn't hire a woman or, you know, a minority. So there's a whole legal conflict. And the there's one right way and a whole bunch of wrong ways to do it. And we do things the right way. We've been doing this for over 50 years.
And I was told that the EEOC still recommends yes. The Hogan assessment.
I think so. That's really how we got started. When the EEOC was first put in place, they said basically these people, if you'll hire the Hogans to fix your unjust hiring processes, if you'll get the Hogans to fix those, we won't sue you.
Wow. That is incredible. I mean, when you think of the litigious nature of you know, government agencies and what that looks like, for them to back your, you know, your assessment, your program, that's phenomenal.
Our stuff, our material, our assessments are blind. They women get the same scores as men, blacks get the same scores as whites, Hispanics get the same scores as blacks. And older workers get better scores than younger workers because they're more mature.
Right, right. What are some of the greatest stories of how your assessments have impacted companies and leaders as they're looking to, you know, as they're building their businesses?
Well, it ends up being mostly pretty anecdotal. I would say there are two lines of evidence regarding. There's what should you do for a career? We do that all day long.
Yep.
Well, you want to have a good career, you need to do this, this, this. You need to stop doing this and this. You need to start doing this and this. So that goes on all day long. And we get testimonials, you know, once a week. You changed my life. You fixed my life. But that didn't count, right? That's just personal one-offs.
Yep.
But what I can point to in a kind of public domain. And, you know, organizations don't like for you to go public with their stuff over there. Everybody's really wants to be secret and proprietary and blah, blah, blah. So the big one I would say from back in the day was Burger King. They own some of their own stores and then the rest of them are franchisees.
Uh-huh.
They implemented our stuff. The most important single factor in the profitability of a convenience of a fast food restaurant is the manager.
Right.
You know what the profile of a good manager looks like. And so so they use our stuff to hire, what do you call them? They're restaurants, I guess they call them stores.
Sure.
Hire the store managers and they made quite a bit of money off of that. So we made a big impact on Burger King back in the day. There's a chain of convenience stores in Pennsylvania called Sheetz.
Mm-hmm.
And they used our stuff for a while. They convenience stores were where we had demonstrable, empirically, you know, verifiable results. But the one that would probably be high profile is we've done some stuff recently with the NFL in head coaches.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. But then they don't like for you to talk about it.
Okay.
But I can tell you that when they pay attention, When they don't, when they ignore us, they fail. And when they pay attention, they make the playoffs.
That's terrific.
And I can show you the data. Well, I would show you the data, but they won't let me.
I understand. Is that personal development, or is that team development, or is that a combination of both?
It's getting the right guy in the head coach job. Yeah, it really matters who's in charge.
It does.
The guy said a long time ago, it was a great line. He said, "Winners win and losers lose."
So why is it important to get that head coaching position, or that number one leader, that president? Why is that such a critical decision?
Well, everything falls from that. You get the right guy in place, the right guy put the right processes in place, the right guy will staff appropriately. And personality of the leader drives the engagement of the workforce. The engagement of the workforce drives the performance of the business unit or the team. That's it. Personality of the leader drives the engagement of the workforce. Engagement of the workforce is directly correlated. It's the best single predictor of the performance of the business unit or team. Full stop.
Yep.
You hear him say this on ESPN. So-and-so has, quote, lost the team. Coach at Philadelphia Eagles, who just got fired. Peterson. Doug Peterson.
Oh, Doug Peterson. Yeah, Doug Peterson.
Yeah, he made a bad call at the end of the game, and he just lost the team. The team lost confidence. So if you're in charge, people are watching you constantly. They're looking for several things. They want to know, first of all, if they can trust you. Are you an honorable person? Are you a liar? Mm-hmm. Are you stealing from the company? You know, are you self-dealing? Are you playing favorites? So the first thing is, can you be trusted? Second thing they want to know is, do you know what you're talking about?
Right.
If you're in charge, people are going to be coming to you all day long for advice about how to do this, that, or the other thing. If you don't know what you're talking about, you're screwed. You can't help. And one of the things a manager does all day long is help people solve problems. They can tell very quickly what you're talking about, or if you don't. And if you don't, you're just done. I mean, in terms of knowing what you're talking about, there's on the one hand, I mean, do you know how to actually solve functional problems for the organization? But there's the other part of that is your decision making. The decision, I mean, troops really care about the quality of your decision making. In the Vietnam War, I don't know if you're old enough to remember Vietnam.
Yes, I am. Mm-hmm.
But a lot of guys got promoted into officers' ranks without much training, and now they're in combat in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. In Vietnam, something like 5,000 junior officers were killed by their own troops because the troops thought the officers would get them killed. So, I mean, it really matters to the troops. Are you a liar? Are you a cheat? Are you stealing? Are you do you know what you're talking about? And can you make good decisions? If you can't make good decisions, they're going to leave you in a hurry. And then the last thing folks want to know is, can you generate an appealing or a compelling or an attractive vision for, you know, why are we doing this? What's the point?
Yeah.
And that's where junior officers were really screwed in Vietnam, because nobody knew what the point was.
Right.
So it's integrity, it's competence, and it's vision. It's obviously a lot more complicated than that. You have to keep it really simple.
Keep it simple. So now you've kept it simple: integrity, competence, and vision. Now let's get a little bit more complex and dive into the weeds. So you've identified the three main components: the HDS, HPI, and the MPVI. How did you come to those three main themes?
What those three inventories do is they're items on each one of them. So there's a set of about 450 items.
Uh-huh.
And that's the DNA of personality. Various configurations of those items will predict performance at anything, and predict it in a fairly discrete way. So those are just represent item pool. The HPI is what we call the bright side. And that's what you see in an interview. That's what you see in a job interview. That's what you see on a first date. It's people when they're at their best. And if a person can't put on an attractive bright side performance, you're already done, right?
Right.
Yeah, right. So that's the bright side. So what do they look like when they're trying to make a good impression? The HDS is about the dark side. Hmm. That's what do you see after you married them?
Yep.
What do you see after they come to work? What do you see when they let down their guard? So, and then the MVPI is the inside. It's It's values. It's basic values, and, you know, it's values. Values are different from you know, behaviors. So the HPI comes from research on the structure of normal personality. And around the world, everyone agrees that you can talk about normal personality, the bright side, in terms of, they say five dimensions, they're wrong, seven dimensions. So the HPI is the first measure of normal personality based on what they call, what's called the five-factor model. That's the structure of normal personality.
Okay, now the five-factor model, that's the big five, the ocean?
Yeah.
Okay, and now you've added
there's
two.
There's actually seven, but they got it wrong. But,
so let's,
and
let's
I'm
just,
the guy that introduced the five-factor model to the academic world.
You introduced the five-factor model?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
But I didn't get credit for it. So anyway.
But hang on. RT, the five-factor model, the ocean, help me with that. Let's just go through and identify those for everyone quickly. Well, C is consciousness, E is extroversion, aggressiveness or agreeableness, N is neuroticism.
What's
O again? O is
openness.
Openness, thank you.
Yeah.
And what are the other, what are the two that you added to it? You said it went from five to seven.
There are two. The openness dimension splits into two parts.
Okay.
One part is creativity.
Yep.
And one part is doing well in school.
Got it.
You know, enjoying training.
Yes.
And they're not the same. So that's a really, so those predict very different outcomes. The openness thing predicts vision, imagination, creativity, or none.
Right.
Literal mindedness at the low end. And then the other one predicts, will you pay attention to, are you curious?
Interesting. Wow.
So the low scores on that prefer to learn from experience. High scores on that like to learn from, you know, they read.
Right.
Okay, so the openness dimension splits into, and it really does, it's quite robust. They just get it wrong. Into a creativity dimension and an information-seeking dimension.
Mm-hmm.
What's the key to a successful career? Winners are people who want to win.
Right.
In the five-factor model misses the most important single component of careers, which is ambition. Full stop. We're the only people on earth who talk about ambition. What's the difference between, you know, a winner and a loser? It's about drive. It's about wanting to win. Ambition is about winning. Five-factor model completely ignores the most important single factor in career development, which is called ambition. Winners win. Well, who are the winners? They're people who want to win and are willing to work hard to do it.
The older I get, RT, and the more I can, you know, add repetitions to utilizing the assessment and how it flushes out with individuals' career paths, the more I'm amazed at how important, how critical drive is and how that...
Oh, it's everything.
I mean...
Winners win. So that's where the bright side comes from. It comes from, you know, ordinary language captures social reality. Five-factor model comes from basically a statistical analysis of ordinary language. It's just data reduction procedures. So you can boil ordinary language about people down to those five dimensions, but there are really seven. Then the dark side comes from the study of managerial failure. What we know is that managers fail for about nine reasons consistently. You know, some yell and scream, some argue and fight, some won't communicate, some won't shut up, some lie and steal. You know, narcissism, psychopathy, these are all reasons. And the thing about the dark side is that you have to be around them. The bright side covers it over. So you have to be around them a while to see the dark side tendencies. Dark side tendencies are very distinct from the bright side tendencies. It's paranoia. It's, it's all those things. So that's the dark side. And then what I call the inside, the core values, probably the best person I ever met in academic psychology was a guy named John Holland. And he's the best, most important guy in the history of vocational counseling psychology. He came up with a six variable model of vocational interest. And it's definitive. All vocational interests can be captured in terms of these six dimensions of his. There's you know, people who do engineering, work on and build and maintain equipment. That's the sort of engineers and, you know, auto mechanics. Then there are people who do research, you know, biologists and physicists. Mm-hmm. And there are people who appear at halftime on the Super Bowl, you know, artists.
Right.
Then there's HR, the altruists, you know, psychotherapists, pastors, ministers. Then there are go-getting businessmen like yourself. Mm-hmm. And then finally, there are bean counters. And that's all in the whole world of vocational interest could be. So that's where the MVPI came from. I knew John Holland really well. I loved that model, but I thought it missing a few things. So just because you want to be an artist and you're happy being an artist doesn't mean you'll be any good at it. So you need some extra push.
Right. And that's
where power comes from. You know.
And that's one of the things we're really passionate about is creating a world where everyone, you know, is really excited to, you know, to in their vocation. And sometimes individuals just become miscasts, right? We see this a lot, certainly helping family-owned businesses create a strong succession plan in them thinking that, you know, everybody should be a great president. When oftentimes that just isn't the case.
So the scales on those three inventories can be broken down into items. And between those items, we can capture pretty much in a very fine grained way, we can capture performance in any job. But we have data on every job in the U.S. economy. Actually, we have data on performance for every job in the U.S. economy.
Wow.
We have data for performance in every job in the world economy. We have millions of data points.
RT, let's just talk about from the data perspective, right? So to have sustained your prominent position in psychological assessments, there has to have been some type of refining of the product or evolution. I mean, when you've gone from...
Well, yeah, we do research all the time. We have like 10 full-time PhD researchers. We have the largest research group in the world. And then we just do research all day long. I mean, it's constantly. So here comes... We test a bunch of truck drivers. We test a bunch of airline pilots. We test a bunch of accountants. We test a bunch of convenience store managers. We test a bunch of movie theater operators, you know, and then you run the numbers and file it away. And we've been doing this since the mid-70s. So
wow.
We really care about data, we care about the integrity of our data. And so our problem is just one of marketing. We really suck at marketing. Yeah. We started as an academic organization. So we get killed in the marketing department. We know more about all this stuff than anybody. It's just, we're not very good at marketing.
Got it. And so now, as you mentioned, there's a number of products out there that have been excellent at marketing that that don't have any scientific foundation to them at all.
Whatsoever, yes.
Right. And one of them that I think, you know, I would, you know, if you'd be so kind, any thoughts on the DISC profile?
Oh, it's just trivial. I mean, it's a knockoff of the Myers-Briggs, okay, which is a party game. It's not, our line is, we'll run a horse race anytime you please, which is, we'll pay for the data, we'll pay for the analyses, test a group of people with the DISC, test a group of people with the HPI, and then we'll see which one predicts performance best, and we'll pay for the analyses, we'll pay for the data collection, and we never, ever lose a horse race. You know, you got a Chevrolet, I've got a Ford. Who's got the faster car? It's only one way to find out, right?
Right, right. And continually, you've tested your model against performance.
Yes. Well, that's all there is.
I look forward to exploring more kind of this persistence that you have and making certain that the product that you're generating is really impacting organizations and really helping them.
Well, if they use it and keep track, they always make more money. You know, inside these organizations at the top, it's all politics all the time.
Right.
It's really rare when you can find someone working in an organization who actually cares about making the organization better. They're mostly about making them improve. And that brings me to the most important single point in this conversation. I was looking at your questions and leadership. I'm an absolute maniac on the subject of leadership. And this is where everybody gets it wrong. Let me give you, how do you find good leaders? Well, that's probably not even a worthwhile question. Question is getting rid of the bad ones. So what's the base rate of managerial incompetence in corporate America? Police departments, fire departments, parks and recreation, the U.S. Department of Treasury, United States Marine Corps, Goldman Sachs, name a big architecture firm. What's the base rate of managerial incompetence in corporate America, public and private sector? Base rate of managerial incompetence is about 65 to 75%. 6 or 7 out of every 10 existing managers, Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Delta Airlines, Prudential Life Insurance, 6 or 7 out of every 10 managers is driving their staff crazy. Full stop. The data on this have been around since the 60s. Just nobody, most companies are dysfunctional. It's kind of one how they stay in business. So just three quick pieces of number. These numbers are quite robust. First, 65 to 75% of the U.S. workforce say they would take a pay cut if someone fired their boss.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
65%. Another one is 65 to 75% of the U.S. workforce say the worst, the most stressful, the most awful part of their life is their immediate boss. Okay?
Yep.
And 20% of the Baltimore workforce say they fantasize daily about murdering their boss. I know. So that's where to start, is to get rid of the bad ones. Get rid of the bad ones, and that's an easy deal. They make the mistake during the hiring process. They hire someone who sucks up to them. They don't hire someone. They say, you know, you have to, my line, there are certain areas of human performance where everyone thinks they're great. So everyone, the data are real on this. Everyone thinks they have a great sense of humor.
Yep.
They do.
Mm-hmm.
95% of the people think they have a great sense of humor.
Yep.
Everyone thinks they're a great driver.
Right. Yep.
Guess mm-hmm. what? And everyone thinks they're a great judge of character.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And all you people who've been divorced, take one step forward, which is 50%, 55% of you.
Right.
Yeah. So you have to get rid of that. I'm a good judge of character and start using validated, you know, statistically appropriate techniques for making these hiring decisions. And that's how you fix it. Bosses don't know who their good managers are. They just know who they like.
So how much of the assessment profiles or the benchmark markers that you utilize, how much does that change from environment to environment, culture to culture? So if you're looking at leadership in the Navy or leadership in distribution business, it's
where they differ from China to Japan to Taiwan to Philippines to Australia is in terms of their values. The MVPI profiles differ across cultures.
Okay.
It's not, you know, not talking about success stories. It's getting rid of these people who are driving folks crazy.
Right.
And, you know, it's really just so obvious. So Amazon, I mean, why do you get labor agitation? Bad management. Big article in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend. What's going on in that fulfillment plant in Alabama? They hate their managers.
Right.
Why do they hate their managers? They got promoted based on technical skills. They didn't get promoted based on talent for management. They take the best coder in the mob. They take the best mechanic in the shop and make him a manager. They lose a good mechanic and get a bad manager.
Right.
It is really dumb and it's really that obvious. And it's really easily fixed.
It is easily fixed, but what's the largest challenge? Just overcoming individuals' ego?
Getting past the HR managers.
Yeah.
And usually, if you can get to an operations guy, they'll pay attention.
Right.
But
right.
HR is all about politics, and they don't want to look bad. And so,
but leaders are supporting that, right? Are supporting that, you know, whoever the HR individual reports to, supporting the political dynamic of,
right.
who they like versus, you know, more of a meritotic, you know, more of a, you know, performance based dynamic.
Without getting into too much academic detail, it's really, really, there's a really important distinction to be made between leader emergence and leader effectiveness. And there are very, very good hard data on this. Inside every organization, there'll be certain people who are seen as high potentials.
Yes.
They're the ones that get the fast pay raises and the fast good jobs and rapid promotions. And then there's a group of people whose teams are performing well, and they're not the same people. They don't overlap at all. They don't overlap.
Really? Why?
Well, and so you, and
again,
so,
a political dynamic or what?
And it's how they spend their time. So the ones we call emergent, the ones who rise rapidly,
yes,
the high potentials,
yes,
they spend their time doing politics. They spend their time networking. They spend their time on the phone.
Got it.
And the ones that are running high-performing teams spend their time working on their teams.
Wow.
And the organizations hire the noisy fans and they ignore the guys that are running successful. So you got to pay attention. You got to say, what's the manager supposed to do? Supposed to create a high performing team. Who's got the high performing team? That's your best manager. Not who talks the most in a staff meeting. And that's what's wrong with American business at its heart. That's the fundamental problem. This distinction between emergence and effectiveness. They're not the same people. And they're easy to identify, you know, easy to profile there, but I can tell you who they are up front. So every high potential program on earth is designed to identify the high flyers who are good at getting to the top and are not good at running anything. Do you read the paper on the weekend?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Wall Street Journal. Yep, cover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this Sunday's New York Times business section there was a guy named Jeffrey Immelt. He was the number two guy at GE.
Yeah, I've been following the GE situation very closely.
Yeah, he ruined GE.
He did. Well, I agree.
Big, huge story on him in the Sunday's business section of the New York Times, where he's telling his story now.
And his really?
Story is that he was undermined. He was undermined by insubordinate subordinates. It wasn't his fault. He was victimized. Jack Welch didn't support him appropriately. There's all those guys over there. Anyway, he's just a big, you know, big hair. He was just a noisy fan. He's a salesman.
He was a salesman. Yes, exactly.
He was,
yes. He was a cheerleader. A cheerleader who didn't make the tough decisions.
Classic, high emergence, low effectiveness. So when he flew around in the corporate jet, he had an empty jet following him.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, think about that.
Right. Right. But furthermore, didn't make the tough decisions, and I've been watching very closely since the Danaher president or the Danaher CEO has now taken the business over.
Yeah, he's fixing them. He's actually getting them turned around. But he was a real winner at Danaher as well.
He was fantastic at Danaher, and that's a case study that I'm very close to and study a lot, and we utilize a number of their tactics as we look to.
His name is Culp, right?
Yes. Yeah. Larry Culp.
He fits our profile of a really good leader. He fits the Hogan profile of a good leader. In addition to everything else, he's humble.
Yep.
The humility is hugely significant. This is another kind of standard error that occurs in all this. People are looking for charisma.
Yeah.
Charisma correlates about as highly with narcissism as height does with weight. I mean, the correlation are almost identical. If you got charisma, you got narcissism. You know what you get with narcissism? You get bad judgment. You get self-dealing. You get taking credit for success and refusing to take credit for failure, blaming subordinates. Anyway, the good ones are humble, and Culp is humble. And it's the antithesis of charisma. That is, we call it the myth of charismatic leadership. It's just gone. It's just, I can tell you where it all comes from. It was in the 70s. Activist investors, guys like Carl Icahn and T. Yep. Boone Pickens,
mm-hmm.
They said, I got all this money in your company and I'm not getting the kind of returns I deserve.
Right.
So there was this paper, Harvard Business Review paper by a guy named Jensen and some other guy who said, well, the trick is called the problem of alignment. It's how do you align in a public company, in a family business like mine, it's easy to align the managers with the business. But in a publicly traded company, how do you align the manager's interest with the company's interest? So that's what they said, pay them with stock, you know, tie their compensation to the stock performance. Okay, so now we got an opening for a CEO. You got two guys. One guy's got a track record, and the other guy says, I can take this company to the next level.
Right.
I can give you the kind of stock financial returns you richly deserve. Mm-hmm. I can do that for you. Well, no one can do that. But then, so who says that? Those are items on a narcissism scale.
Right, right.
That's where it all went wrong. They started hiring people based on claims about their ability to take the company to the next level. That's the kind of statements that a narcissist make. That's not the kind of statement that, so it's all about humility. It's not about charisma. And that's where a big, big problem there.
But to be human, though, is to be like a moth to the flame, right? When we see charismatic individuals, we're immediately drawn to them, right?
And yes. And that's a big mistake. Big mistake.
So the critical part to maneuver past that is to focus on the results, to focus on...
Yeah. No, it's to ask The consumers are the past leadership. Go ask the troops. The troops always know who the good leaders are.
Yeah. So 360 reviews then, just being very open,
candid,
right?
Yeah. My wife's niece quit her job at company. They live in Iowa, which is just south of you, equally cold. And she went from company A to B. I think they live in Des Moines. I don't know where they live. They live somewhere. All those places in Iowa look the same. So they moved from job A to job B, and then she called my wife. She said, "I'm so excited." She says, "In the new company, I'm going to work for the best manager in the company." So all the troops knew who the best manager was.
Right.
And she was excited. Well, and they know. So, and they do know. So there you go. It's all pretty, the answer to all this is pretty straightforward. The problem is at the top of these organizations, it's all ego and politics. And it's not, you know, are you working for your own career? Or are you working for the organization? If you're working for the organization, you'll listen to us. If you're working for your, you know, if you're pushing your own career, then we don't have anything to tell you. We can't tell you anything anyway.
Well, thank you so much for the insight. Again, I really appreciate this. To recap the wisdom Dr. Hogan shared with all of us, leadership comes down to whether people value a person's integrity, competence, and vision. Integrity. How often can a person be trusted in tempted ethical moments when no one is looking? Competency. What's the person's ratio of good to poor decision-making skills historically? Vision. How effective is the professional at articulating the why to what the purpose is behind what the team's initiatives are? What's at stake? As Dr. Hogan, I thought, did a great job of defining very clearly, the personality of the leader defines the engagement of the workforce. I mean, that's it. It starts at the top. Leaders are the ones that are defining what direction the teams are going and simply what the level of performance is going to be from that team. Why do companies struggle making leadership hires? They think they're being objective in their assessment when they simply are not, falling victim to the popularity contest or other subconscious political and intuitive pitfalls. And as I promised, this one's gonna rock some people. What is the top trait of leaders with poor integrity and decision-making skills? Charisma. As Dr. Hogan states, charisma correlates as highly with narcissism as height and weight does with humans. And of course, with narcissism, you get bad judgment and self-dealing. Remember, it's not whether you think the candidate has the desire and traits that mattered. It's based on the outcomes and facts of their personal and professional lives. It's nearly impossible for a hiring leader to have the perfect interview process on their own, as hiring leaders are limited to questions that they can ask, and also time and resources and access to information. Adding the right psychological testing process helps leaders understand the innate personality tendencies, flagging areas to question to determine whether or not the individual has the needed behavioral disciplines to work past those personality gaps. Again, thank you to Dr. Hogan, thank you to Hogan Assessments, and thank you for joining Hire Smarter with Tony Mazura.